welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today, we'll be talking about 1984 by George Orwell. My name is Caroline, and here with me is my father, Richie.
Hello.
Today we're talking about 1984 by George Orwell. We're continuing our project of reading science fiction books, and this set we're doing dystopias. So, Dad, I think you wanted to address something else before we jump in, though, right?
Right. So, a friend of ours pointed us to another podcast, which is called Classical Things You Should Know, which covered Brave New World. So if you want to hear another point of view of Brave New World, you could listen to them. They actually mentioned us in their podcast. And one thing that they said, that they didn't understand what history in reverse was. So here's a short explanation for those people who don't like to read short notes. We're talking about science fiction. History is when you talk about stuff that happened in the past. Science fiction is about stuff that's going to happen in the future. So it's history in reverse. Get it?
Pretty simple. Yeah, I think we explained it the first like one or two podcasts, and then then we assumed you all listened to the first few, so
that's
we stopped.
Right.
But that's the explanation, yes.
So the other thing, if you listen to our Brave New World podcast, there's one thing that the guys in the classical stuff you should know noticed, which I don't think we observed. Mm-hmm. One of the things they said is that, we realized this, that in Brave New World, sexuality was divorced from childbearing completely.
Yes.
Now, mind you, when Huxley wrote that was 1930s, that was no such thing. But when the pill was invented, essentially what we live today in a Brave New World, where sexuality is divorced from childbearing.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a point that they made. So it's in some ways, today is that part of Brave New World came true.
Oh, interesting. No, I hadn't thought about that. Well, that's a really good point.
Anyway, so much for Huxley. Let's move on to George Orwell.
George Orwell. Okay, you want to tell us a little bit about the context? So 1984, the book was not written in 1984.
No. Okay. Well, 1984 was written in 1948. This was historically right after World War II, and there was a rather large rise of communism in Europe and in Asia, so the Soviet Union, a whole bunch of satellite countries, mm-hmm. including the country where I grew up in, in Poland, which we'll talk about mm-hmm. what it was like then. This book was in part kind of the reaction to the rise of communism. George Orwell didn't like communism, didn't think it was any good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were people more in like in the 20s and the 30s who thought that communism might be a better way to structure society than capitalism. And I think after the war, with fall of fascism and stuff, a lot of people were disappointed, just disillusioned, I guess, about the possibility mm-hmm. of communism. And Soviet Union become quite terrible as a place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so Orwell, was writing kind of to explore the idea, to the max, basically, what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. One of the things you heard about when you were growing up in communist country, that it was a dictatorship of the People's Party. So there was one party that was the Communist Party was the dictatorship. And there were no other parties. And this is very similar to I guess, 1984 setup.
Yeah, and even that kind of language, the dictatorship of the People's Party, is kind of very,
right.
like, propaganda kind
yes.
of stuff.
Yes, yes. And the other thing I think that kind of shows what the world looks like in 1984, the book, it reminds me of some stuff I've read about what the world was like, in London during the war, because mm-hmm. London was being bombed regularly, but mm-hmm. people still went about their own lives. Just every now and then, bombs would fall and kill some people,
yeah.
and they would clean up and continue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were willing to put up with lots of shortages and rationing and stuff because there was the war on, and
right.
there was the war to be won.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and I've read some stuff about American history too, about when the United States, finally joined World War II and everything towards the end. And there was all kinds of things like having you had a victory garden where you grew your own vegetables, and
right.
you had to ration and save.
Right.
And there was like this sort of big push, support for the war, support
right.
the country for the war effort. So I think what he's describing here is largely based on what he was seeing in real life,
right?
And the ways people were reacting.
Also, we think that in some ways this was Orwell's response to Brave New World, because Orwell mm-hmm. was Huxley's student, as we mentioned it before,
mm-hmm.
and he did not think very highly of Brave New World. I guess in terms of ideas, I don't know what he thought about the writing, and he thought it was just way too nice, I think.
Mm-hmm. And there's definitely some lines in the book that seem to address that specifically, and there's a lot of themes and patterns that are either exactly the same or are polar opposites between the two. And yet, both are somehow dystopia books.
Right.
So that's kind of one of the things we're going to talk about. So first we're going to go through and do an overview of the plot, broadly. And
right, spoiler alert, but I mean, I assume you've
right.
read the book.
Spoiler alert, Winston dies. Maybe. I don't know.
Who knows?
Yeah, we'll get there.
I used to think that.
So the book starts in Oceania, which is a country that he seems to be in London.
Yeah.
Yeah. It may or may not actually be 1984. We don't ever get any confirmation of what year it really is.
Right.
And that's part of the whole thing is that our main character, Winston Smith, doesn't really know anything for sure. It's very difficult to know anything for sure except for relying on your own memory. And even then, you know, his
And why is that?
That's because of the party. And because of Big Brother. You want to explain what the party is?
Well, so the world seems to be ruled by the party, and the elites are members of the party.
The inner party.
Yeah, there's several layers of the party. So the inner party is like the super duper elites, and there's just like regular party members like Winston.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of work they do is to basically keep the party in power. Besides them, there's a population that they refer to as proles, which is like the proletariat.
Right.
You know, they kind of live down their lives. And
they make up the vast majority of the population.
That's what it sounds
like.
They're
like 80% or something.
Right.
There's like the most.
But they have no power. They're just basically, I don't want to say slaves, because they kind of live their own lives, but they're not concerned. They're not educated. They they like to go to pubs and drink, you know.
And gamble.
And gamble, right.
Yeah. So Winston Smith works, he's a party member. And he works at one of the ministries. He works at the Ministry of Truth, which is involved in disseminating lies.
Well, so, no, Ministry of Truth, it's not disseminating lies. It just corrects the records to match the current truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the points that he makes that why it's hard to remember things, it's because if you remember something today, you can, you know, look up what the papers were saying, you know, 10 years ago. And so, okay, I remember 10 years ago this happened. Look, there's evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And in Brave New World, in the 1984 world, Winston's job is to go and correct the records.
Right. Exactly. So for like one of the things we see is he gets an assignment at work where they say, you know, this person is now an unperson. The person no longer exists. So he has to go back and remove that person's existence from various records to make sure that if anybody were to look for the person, it's like the person was vaporized. That's how
they refer to it.
Refers to
but
it.
The other interesting thing is, you know, party being perfect and doing everything best. For example, they have chocolate rations, right?
Yeah.
So chocolate rations are like, you know, 5 grams a week or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to reduce them because of reality,
mm-hmm.
actual reality, and to two grams a week or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Winston then goes and changes all the statements that were made in papers about how much chocolate people get, and they realized they were always getting 2 grams a week, and they're very happy because it was increased from 1 gram a week.
Right, exactly. So it's all part of that, the propaganda machine that's going on, and Winston is an active participant in it, as you know, he's making these changes, and he's aware he's making these changes.
Right, I guess it's thought control, right?
Right, exactly. So that's one of the ministries, is the Ministry of Truth, the Ministry of Peace.
Right.
Which is concerned with war.
Right.
Which we don't really get to see much inside of
right.
the Ministry of Peace.
It's Ministry of Plenty.
Yeah, Mini Plenty.
Which is the one that deals with economy and reduces the rations of things.
Right. and then
Ministry of Love.
The Ministry of Love, which we get to at towards the very end. Ministry of Love is a giant building with no windows. And it's scary. Winston's afraid of it from the very beginning. The very first time he describes it, he describes how frightening it is.
Right.
And if you can't even get near the Ministry of Love, there's like guards and stuff, even a few blocks out. So that's kind of where we're at, and we...
So there's also this, in the beginning you find out that basically the life of Winston is kind of drab. He lives in this like
shitty apartment.
Pretty bad apartment, yeah. and kind of run-down buildings.
Yeah.
And every apartment has a telescreen, mm-hmm. which observes you and tells you what to do. Like, you know, wakes you up, makes you do exercise in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. And keeps tabs on you.
Right.
Just like the FBI guys that watch us through our phones now.
Right, just like Alexa.
For my FBI guy, I think capitalism is great. I don't think communism is good. I'm going to say that for the record. But, yeah, so the telescreen, like, literally watches them all the time, and there are these big posters around, right, that tell them.
Right, so one of the things is Big Brother, right? So there's a figure of this man, Big Brother, and mm-hmm. posters of him everywhere. Mm-hmm. And Big Brother is, like, assumed to be the head of the government, the party, mm-hmm. but you never actually see him.
Right, and all the posters say Big Brother is watching you, which is the, you know, probably one of the most famous lines
right.
from 1984. But literally the party is watching you on the telescreens, or sometimes through microphones.
Around. Like, you know, for example, if you dream about unapproved thoughts, you can be vaporized.
Right, if you're talking in your sleep or anything like that, absolutely. So the story begins, we pick up with Winston when he's done something that is not going to be approved of. He's bought a diary, and he's going to write in it.
Right, it's a blank notebook.
Right.
Right, so what happens is, I think he wandered around some of the prol areas.
Right.
Which are not quite as
they're not
under such surveillance.
Right, yeah. And party members all wear the same uniform. They all wear blue overalls.
Right.
I don't know what that imagery means. Does that mean something? Is that supposed to be significant? I'm sure it is.
Look at the workers are great posters that are
Russian
art. You know, they always wear like these, like a denim bluish kind of, you know, muscular workmen building mm-hmm. the communism thing. You know.
Oh, I see. Okay. They wear these very significant blue overalls. So it's obvious, easy to pick the party members out. So when a party member goes to a prol area, they stand out. So he had gone wandering around and had come across this like antique shop kind of
right.
thing. Bought this diary. And this is part of sort of the first action Winston takes after many years of beginning to question what's going on around him, how life used to be, whether life used to be better or not.
And he can't remember.
Right.
He's trying to remember, but...
He has some memories of his childhood and stuff, but he's sort of at an interesting generation in this society because he was a child when the revolution happened.
Right.
And he was young enough that he has vague memories of it, but not specific memories
like
of it.
Like, he has some memories of his mother.
And his sister.
And his sister,
like,
right.
And he remembers, like, when they went, the day they went missing and stuff like that. But he doesn't really remember many details about what life was actually like before the revolution. So, he buys his diary. And I think our first chapter with him is he takes it home and starts writing
it. Right. So, he thinks there's a spot in his apartment where the telescreen cannot see him.
Yeah.
And so he opens a diary and writes some stuff in it, including, mm-hmm. what did he say about Big Brother? Down with Big Brother.
Yeah. He writes in this, like, fury where he's just like, he needs to get these thoughts out. He can't contain them anymore.
Right.
And he writes every couple of chapters different things in this diary.
I don't know if you noticed the one thing that he does. He wants to make sure that nobody touches his diary, so he wants to know. So when he puts it in his desk, he puts like a little piece of dust on it in a spot, just so that if somebody moves it, he expects that will be moved.
Right, he would know if the dust was moved. He's trying. But that said, from the very first chapter, there's a lot of foreshadowing. The story is one of the big structural things about it from the very beginning. The story tells us where it's going because Winston's like, "Well, I'm gonna be killed. They're gonna shoot me. They're gonna vaporize me." And even in that first chapter, he thinks to himself, "They'll shoot me in the back of the neck eventually." And then he goes downstairs to help his neighbor. His neighbor needs help fixing something, and the little boy has a slingshot or something.
Yeah, right.
And hits him with it in the back of the neck, and it's a parallel. The interesting thing, and we were talking about this a little before the podcast, the interesting thing about 1984 is there's some, like, it's a great book to teach to, like, high schoolers because there's some very straightforward literary things that are very simple to understand, like, that's a parallel, that's foreshadowing, you know, that kind of thing. And then there's some, like, crazy, insane themes here that I've only realized on this read-through that are really high level that I love. So, like, that's, like, a kind of easy parallel that happens.
So there's part when he describes, like, his day at work where he sits at his desk. Mm-hmm. They have these pneumatic tubes. See, this is kind of funny because we said, you know, in today's world, this would be all done by computers. They had no computers there.
Yeah.
But this is pneumatic right. tubes where the articles come in and he has to rewrite them. But they have speak type, so they have some...
He has a thing like he can talk into it to redo the article. It's interesting.
So basically, article comes and tells him, you know, what has to be changed in it. So he rewrites it, mm-hmm. and the new one is submitted, and the old one is thrown into the memory. Is the memory hole.
Yeah.
Where it basically gets burned. And when something big happens, they have to basically go back and change lots of records and things like that.
So he's constantly doing work.
So he's doing that kind of work, and at his office, there's a girl. That he kind of sort of seems to be interested in, but they don't talk or anything.
Well, he thinks she's a member of the Thought Police.
Oh, so what is the Thought Police?
That's a great question. The Thought Police is one of the staples of this universe, is that they are the police that... They are the people that watch to see if your thoughts and your way of thinking are turning out to be contrary to party doctrine. And they're super scary because they're the ones that watch you through a telescreen, but also watch you in other ways. And they're like spies. You never know who's a member of the Thought Police. And this girl he sees, the dark-haired girl, is so... Like, he interprets her as being, like, so pure and so, like, strongly for the party and so orthodox that, like, she's got to be a member of the Thought Police and she's, like, the worst kind of person. And Winston expresses particularly... Almost anger, but like concern with women in the party. And he says, you know, all women are always the worst. They're the ones who are like really into this whole party thing.
Right.
And, you know, she's one of the worst ones.
He had kind of a bad experience with his wife, right?
Yeah, no, he didn't have a good experience with his wife.
At work also, they have, I guess every day they have this thing called the 2 minutes of hate.
Yeah.
So, which basically what it is they go... I'm not sure if it was like a separate room they went to in front of a big screen mm-hmm. where they were basically indoctrination for 2 minutes. And the person that was hated was this, counter-revolutionary named Emmanuel Goldstein.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not clear whether he's a real person or an imaginary person. Mm-hmm. But basically, they would have like a mini rally. They would rile everybody up and everybody would scream how they hated him.
Right.
Right.
And they show his picture and his voice would become the bleeding of a goat or a sheep or something.
Right.
And his face would become a sheep face. It was like all, you know, kind of classic straightforward kind of propaganda stuff happening. And, you know, everyone would be shouting and Winston would join in.
Of course. I mean, you had to at least pretend that you were into it. Yeah. So in one of those rallies, 2 minutes of fate, something happens between him and this guy, O'Brien.
Yes.
Can I explain that?
So O'Brien's another guy. He's a member... Does Winston know he's a member of the inner party at that point?
I think he's a high level...
Yeah, he's like a higher level person. And Winston has significant eye contact with O'Brien during this meeting. It's almost like a romance. Like they see each other from across the room. And they have this eye contact. And O'Brien does this thing where he like takes his glasses off or like resettles his glasses on his face and whatever, and it's like very Winston thinks it's like just the bee's knees that he does this with his glasses, and Winston thinks that O'Brien seems like someone he can talk to and
someone can trust. It's not clear whether it's myth or it's true
mm-hmm.
about this underground existing which called the Brotherhood,
right?
And Winston has been like hearing things about it here and there. I'm not sure where. And he suspects that maybe O'Brien is a person
who knows about it. Right. And he feels like compelled to talk to O'Brien and stuff, but obviously they don't say anything, but they had the significant eye contact and Winston thinks about it. And Winston, I think before that significant eye contact, had a dream about O'Brien, where Winston's walking down the street or something like that, and he passes O'Brien and O'Brien says, "We'll meet in the place where there is no darkness."
Right, that's right.
And it's this dream and then the significant eye contact and Winston starts to think, you know, I'm making contact with the Brotherhood, basically.
Right.
So I guess the next action that happens, and this takes place over a long period of time, like days and days pass in between things, because they have to be very careful not to do too many suspicious things all at once.
Right.
He is walking in the hallway at work, and the dark-haired girl is walking towards him.
Right.
They're going to pass each other, and her arm is being sling. For some reason. Injured. And she trips and falls. And he goes to help her up. He helps her up, and she says thank you, and she keeps going, and he keeps going. But in that interaction, she passes him a little piece of paper.
Right.
And he takes a piece of paper back to his office, and he...
I think he has to go, like, to the bathroom or something, because he can't...
No, he won't go read it in the bathroom, because he's like, there's so many telescreens in there.
Right.
Apparently, they're really, really watching you in the bathroom. But he goes, he takes it back to his desk, and he hides it under the other papers, and works for a while.
Right.
And then manages to, like, sneak a glimpse at it. And do you remember what the note says?
Yes, the note says, I love you. And he says, wow.
He's like,
That's different.
Yeah. So he's not sure if it's a trap, you know, if she's a member of the thought police and this is a trick. He ends up throwing the note into the memory tube.
Right.
Gets rid of it.
But then he wants to talk to her, so it's like, it takes a long time. He tries to like sit next to her in the cafeteria.
Right, and then all these guys interrupt him. There's all these side characters that he works with that he doesn't like.
Right.
Parsons is the guy that seems really into the party, and then there's
one who's like into Newspeak.
Sim is into Newspeak. We gotta talk about Newspeak at some point. But so you know, it takes him a while, but he manages to sit at the table with Julia or with the dark hair girl.
Right.
At some point.
Right, and how do they finally arrange to meet?
They at the table. She gives him instructions to meet her at a rally.
Right. So they can walk together.
Right. So they meet at the rally by, like, the base of a statue or something. And then she gives him instructions to meet her in some other place later on.
Right, outside the city.
Right. And very complicated, like, take a train and go left and go
right,
track that has a bar over it and go through the bushes, like, all the kind of thing. So Winston goes. And then what happens when Winston goes?
Well, they meet in this clearing out in the woods where they think nobody watches them. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you think would happen, it happens. And it turns out she's kind of a radical herself,
mm-hmm.
right? And they basically kind of start carrying on the love affair.
Mm-hmm. And her name is Julia?
Her name is Julia.
Did you ever find out her last name?
No, I don't think so.
No, that's loser. Julia's 27,
something right? Like that.
Winston's 39. And Julia's been doing this kind of like sneaky cat and mouse game with the party since she was 16. She said her first love affair is when she was 16. She had several boyfriends throughout that time.
Right, but she's not into necessarily overthrowing a party or philosophy or anything. She just kind of wants to have kind of fun and
survive. She's concerned with survival. So Winston's opinions on whether or not he wants to live kind of go up and down throughout the story. But he's sort of always very pragmatic with and consistent on, like, knowing that eventually the party will get him.
Right.
And Julia's kind of like, nah, like, I've been doing this a long time. We're good. And yeah, she won't really philosophize with him so much. She's interested in enjoying herself and being alive.
Right.
And he's interested in sort of overthrowing the party.
Well, or something.
Yeah, or so, yeah. Finding the Brotherhood or whatever.
So one thing about Winston was married before.
Right.
And his wife just kind of left him. And I think his wife was a good party member.
Yeah,
and
Catherine, yeah.
They got married so that they could reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they could not have children. It's not, they don't say whose fault it was or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, but basically, it's that Catherine, you know, for her, sex was just a very mechanical thing to fulfill party obligations.
Yeah, she would say, we have to do our duty to the party.
Right. And then, of course, when they couldn't, for whatever reason, she left him. And so that was the experience that Winston had with women up until then.
Well, he also had sex with a prostitute at one time.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably more than once, but yeah.
He writes about that in his diary. Yeah, so his relationship to women is very complicated, and that also brings in the relationship to his mother. So throughout this, he's having memories of his mom and his sister, who was who had been a baby at the time.
Right.
He doesn't know what happened to them. They just disappeared. There was a day they were home. He left. He came back. They were gone.
Right.
And he basically remembers as a child always being hungry and always being very difficult. And like he can reflect on the fact
very selfish.
Like, yeah, and he always demanded more food and things like that.
It kind of almost implies that his sister did not survive because he survived, because he...
Well, he thinks both his mother and sister had to die for him. He has a dream towards the beginning, remember, within the... Where he described it sort of like he was looking down at them like through water or something, I think. Or they were in like a deep hole and they're sinking further and further away from him. And he does has this sense that they did not survive so that he could survive. And I wonder if that's true in that the mother was too old to be indoctrinated into the party and the sister was just kind of like a small weak appendage to her that was just kind of dragged under and that. So the party eliminated her and the sister. But Winston was of the right age that he could become a party member.
Right.
Without too much hassle on the part of the party because of the age group he fell into. But we're not sure. That's all speculation.
So the other thing about his affair with Julia is that the place where he found the diary, right, he goes back to that place and he talks to the owner, like an old guy running this shop, and the old guy tells him, I lived here with my wife and there's a room upstairs, you can come and use it if you want to be not observed, right? And they wind up, he and Julia go there to conduct the affair. So rather than going to different places every time, they go to this one place. And is that the time when he buys this coral and glass?
He buys the coral and glass first, and then later ends up renting the room, but they're pretty close in time to each other. So he and Julia meet one time in the forest. Then there's like a church somewhere
they meet. Right.
And then eventually they're like, you know, let's just rent this room. And
so while all this is going on, there's this war happening in the background because we've always been at war with Eurasia. And
with East Asia.
And basically he describes like the city, which to me it sounds like what he probably experienced as a Londoner in World War II, where occasionally like rockets fall in and people get killed and the pearls come out, clean stuff up and life goes on.
There's a great scene where one of the rockets falls or whatever and a human hand is in front of him and it's kind of like white with dust and he kicks it off to the side and it's kind of like keeps living. The rocket scenes are very interesting in the ways that they're described. But so there is this war going on and they're also... the story is sort of centered around, timeline-wise, the Hate Week that's coming up.
Right, right.
So Hate Week is just, I guess, like a big
celebration.
Time, yeah. of, like, hatred. And so for a while, he and Julia are both working really intensely in preparation for Hate Week. And then...
So then O'Brien talks to him.
Yes, before Hate Week, yes.
Right, so... O'Brien stops him. I'm not sure exactly where.
In the hallway somewhere. Where?
Hallway says, he says, I know you work on this, you know, revising all these articles, and there's going to be a new dictionary of Newspeak coming out. I have an early edition. Why don't you stop by my house, and I'll give it to you.
Mm-hmm. And O'Brien writes out his address and gives it to him.
Right. And Winston takes it. That's very significant. Right?
Yeah. So. Winston's like, this must be, like, because otherwise it would be impossible to know where O'Brien lives, right?
Right.
So Winston's like, this must be, you know, this is a sign to me, clearly, whatever. He talks to Julia about it. She's like, cool. They end up going.
Right, they go meet
O'Brien. It's a while later they end up going to O'Brien's house together. And what happens when they go?
So when they get to O'Brien's house, there's a servant that lets them in. And O'Brien says, oh, hi, nice to see you. And then he turns off the telescreen.
Mm-hmm.
And said, oh, my God, you can turn these off?
Yeah. And O'Brien's like, yes.
Yes, but we can, but only for like 30 minutes at a time.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we'll be too suspicious. And then he tells them that he is the member of the Brotherhood and the Underground.
Well, first, before O'Brien says anything, Winston takes like a leap of faith and is like, so I want to destroy the party and join the Brotherhood, and I'm against Big Brother and all. Like, he like makes this big statement about all this stuff. And that's when O'Brien reveals that, in fact, he is a member of the Brotherhood and all these things.
And he tells him, I think, one of the things, you have to be prepared. You know, the Brotherhood is a very loose organization. Mm-hmm. You're not going to meet anybody else from it. And you may have to renounce everything. And are you ready to do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And he says, yes, of course.
Yeah, and they give him all these horrible options of, like, are you ready to kill children and all these things. Yeah.
Right.
But what's the one thing Winston and Julia won't agree to?
Giving up each other.
Right. They won't be separated.
Then O'Brien tells him, okay, we'll give you a book you should read.
Yeah. It's Emmanuel Goldstein's book.
Right.
And it's awesome. And they had to do all kinds of sneaky spy stuff to get it to them. It's like a briefcase switch off and things. So eventually they get the book.
So the just an aside about Emmanuel Goldstein. So there's a large hacker organization, computer hackers and security guys who run this conference. It's been done for like 20 years or so, called HOPE, and a published magazine called 2600. And one of the guys who's like in charge of this whole thing, his name is Emmanuel Goldstein. And I used to think that was a real name, but I realized it's just a pseudonym.
So yeah. That's cute. I like that.
So, you know.
So they get a hold of this book, and then George Orwell falls into one of these tropes that I can't believe how common it is. I'm blown away by this. But basically, there's a chapter.
This is like two chapters almost.
The middle of the story. So I listened to the audio this time, and I know you read the text again. And I've read the text before. And this chapter is like an hour and 20 minutes long or something like that. And there's some other stuff happening in it, but primarily it's Winston and Julia in their little apartment. And Winston reading. He reads like part of the book himself, and then Julia comes in.
Right. So there's the three principles of the party, mm-hmm. right? Which is war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength.
Right.
And Goldstein explains.
Yes, Goldstein explains in excruciating detail how the party works. So what it is almost an entire hour of George Orwell explaining how cool his world is and how interesting and neat his government is that he designed through the words of Goldstein, through Winston reading it. This happened also in Solaris.
Well, Solaris, Brave New World, we had
the whole tour
of the factory.
Brave New World, yeah, it's like... Exposition. So it's very interesting. It's very interesting, but I don't know if it was necessary.
It's kind of I would say it's like borderline philosophy, political science kind of a thing,
right.
Where he talks about, you know, if a country is at war all the time, well, the government can demand stuff of its people, saying, you know, you have to fight to defend your country.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, you have to only get, you know, 2 grams of chocolate a week because we need chocolate for the soldiers on the front.
Right, exactly.
You know, whatever.
And the interesting thing about it is that it sort of establishes that the difference of this party's control versus previous totalitarian control is that the way this one functions is meant to be indefinite. It eliminates any potential of revolution. And what we come to learn from the rest of the story, because Winston does not get to finish the book, unfortunately, what we learn from the rest of the story is that they do that by the thought control that we get to see later. So he reads the book, they fall asleep, and then it's kind of unclear. Did they like oversleep their alarm? Like what happened that they?
It sounds like almost overslept, but they were observed all the time.
Right.
So like the health police knew exactly what they were doing all along.
Right.
They were not secret as they thought. And
right.
So it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter at all, because the shopkeep turned out to be...
Right.
So they wake up in the morning, and they, you know, they kind of have this moment where they're, like, looking out the window, waxing lyrical about life, and how, like, then they're like, we are the dead, or whatever, and then there's a voice behind them, a mechanical voice behind them that says, you are the dead.
Right.
And it turns out there was a telescreen behind a frame.
A picture on the wall, yeah.
And the thought police come in.
Right, and they get arrested. Separated and never see each other again.
Yep. And O'Brien.
O'Brien is the thought policeman.
Yep. O'Brien comes in. Whoops. It turned out the shopkeeper was also a member of the Thought Police. Yeah. So they were, Winston was doomed from the top.
And even they make a point of well, so he's taken to Ministry of Love.
Yes. So now we get to see inside the Ministry of Love. And
basically he's tortured there.
Yeah. And we see other people inside the Ministry of Love that he knew. Amber Forth, who was the poet, I think, is in there at one point. And there's Parsons.
Right.
Parsons, who seems to be, perfectly orthodox, gets turned in by his kids.
Well, it shows you kind of how people react to this kind of arbitrary arrest. Mm-hmm. They said, well, it's a mistake, I didn't do this, blah, blah, blah. You have to, And I think, when he first gets arrested, he sits in this one room with his telescreen observing him. He's not allowed to move, so he moves and yells at him.
Yeah.
And he's very hungry. There's, no food. Mm-hmm. Until somebody drops a piece of bread on the floor and he still can't get it.
Right.
Right, so it's pretty awful torture.
Yeah. So the pretty much that's the last third of the book or so is spent with him in the Ministry of Love. There's regular torture kind of techniques. There's a lot more philosophy stuff happening.
Right, so I think one of the interesting things that George Orwell discusses in this part is how far can torture go, right? So he says, in the past, if you were a rebel against something, mm-hmm. They burn you at the stake. But when you were being burned, you still believed the stuff you believed.
Right. So you were made a martyr, and that was bad for the government.
Right. But what this government wants to do is to basically change your mind, control your thoughts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about this Room 101,
mm-hmm.
which is everybody, who says, okay, you have to go to Room 101, and they scream, anything but to go to Room 101. And we sort of find out at the end what was there, right?
Yeah.
So for a while, Winston is very tortured, very physically. He was starved and beaten.
He's put in pain. And
then he's kind of recovers a bit. They give him food. I think O'Brien starts being the questioner or inquisitor or whatever. And there's one point where he shows him, look, what do you look like? And mm-hmm. He sees himself in the mirror and he looks like this other man he saw early on who was a skeletal kind of.
Right, he's starving, his teeth are gone, he's just awful, awful. And this whole time, O'Brien is always involved in the tortures and everything like that. And O'Brien reveals he's been watching Winston for 7 years.
Right.
He's been...
Including replacing the piece of dust on the diary when they put it back in it.
Yep, he made sure to replace the dust. Crazy kind of stuff here. And O'Brien, O'Brien says he helped write the book, the Goldstein book. Mm-hmm. So George Orwell can use O'Brien to talk more about philosophy and government.
Right.
So there's the physical torture kind of breaks Winston down. He pretty quickly confesses. He knows he has
to confess. He confesses to everything, so it's
whatever. That's not a big deal. And then, like you said, he starts to get treated better. They start to feed him more.
Right, but then they take him to this room where there's this dialing for pain.
That's before they start to treat him better, yeah. The regular pain one.
Right.
Yeah, the regular pain was pretty early. So they start to sort of treat him better. He gains weight. They give him new teeth. He kind of becomes, whatever. And then he realizes that way to win for him would be to, in his last moments of life before the bullet, because he knows he's going to get shot, right? His last moments of life before the bullet enters his brain, to hate Big Brother.
Right.
And O'Brien ends up asking him, what are your feelings about Big Brother? And Winston's honest with him and he says, I hate him. And then where do they take Winston?
Take Winston to Room 101.
Yep. And so Room 101 turns out to be probably not a single room, but the concept of a room.
Right.
That is where they do their best to play out a person's greatest fears.
Right, torture based on their greatest fears.
Right. And Winston's is pretty simple because he's afraid of rats. So they make a torture device that involves rats being able to get out his face and stuff like that. And I guess the point of it is that they want Winston to denounce Julia.
So I got one, what he does as the rats approach his face.
Right.
About to eat it. he says, don't do it to me, do it to Julia. So this is like total betrayal.
Right.
And they stop. And basically, he's kind of broken down. So the thing that George Orwell, I think, wanted to show is how you can really control someone's mind through this kind of torture and stuff, where basically you can't be a rebel that goes, you know, to the stake still thinking what you believed in. Mm-hmm. No, your mind actually is changed to be
right.
Believe what your torturers basically want you to believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Winston gets to that point at the very end.
Right. So the last torture chapter we get is the rat chapter.
Right.
And then he's out and about. He's fine. Then he's,
well, because now he's been, his mind has been changed and he's done.
Right. So he's hanging out at this cafe that he had mentioned earlier in the story that sort of denounced criminals go to.
Right.
And he's having...
Actually, he meets with Julia once.
Oh, yeah. They run into each other.
And they both can tell each other that they, you know, each one denounced the other. So it's like there's nothing left between them anymore.
And it's from what she says, it's clear that they did a similar thing to her with, in terms of the fears. Because she's like, sometimes there's something so awful that you want it to happen to anyone else. Like even someone you really care about.
Right.
We get it. We know. So he goes to this cafe and he's waiting to hear news of the war and he's thinking about the war efforts and things like that.
And he loves Big Brother.
And he loves Big Brother. And the question, I mean, we can, I guess, talk about this now because we're pretty much at the end of the facts. Is he actually being shot in that moment?
Right. So when first time I read the book.
So the way the text describes it is that the text describes him like knowing the bullet's coming. And like feeling it come into his brain, and the last line is that he loves Big Brother. So that's what that's what the text says.
Right.
So what do you think the bullet is real?
Well, first time I read it, mm-hmm. I thought that's what was happening at the very end, that he was walking down the hall and they were shooting him, mm-hmm. and he was dying. This time when I read it through, it didn't seem that way to me. It seemed like he was just thinking about it, but like you said, it doesn't matter anymore, right? Because he basically, Big Brother won, and whether he's alive or dead, it doesn't really matter anymore. His mm-hmm. his mind has been changed. His thoughts are controlled by the party.
Right.
And, you know, they can get him to think exactly what they want him to think, and done.
Right, exactly.
And it's, you know, there is no more Winston, essentially.
Right. So, I think that it's more interesting as a literary device if the bullet's a metaphor. If it's not literally he's not literally having these thoughts that the bullet is entering his skull, right? Partially because it's not really possible to have thoughts as a bullet is entering your skull. It's happening too fast. But
probably.
But I think it's more interesting as a metaphor that's it's as if the bullet has entered his skull.
Right.
That doesn't need to be an actual bullet.
Right.
Because, like you said, he's controlled by the party. Winston Smith is gone,
right,
as we know it. So that's the plot. That was our quick overview.
I'm glad it was quick.
Well, so we had a couple of things. So we made a list of stuff to go through.
Okay, so go ahead.
So let's talk first about dystopia, because that's kind of like our whole shtick here.
Right. So I think this is like the classic dystopia, right?
Yeah.
Where the individual is completely controlled by the government. And mm-hmm. and in the case of 1984, it's as completely as you can. Like, you know, you always think that your thoughts in your head are your own, right?
Right.
Nobody can say what you're thinking. You know, if you just keep quiet, mm-hmm. they won't know.
Right. And the government's controlling reality too, right? So they're able to control the past and everything like that. And I think the reason this is a dystopia as opposed to a utopia, I think those descriptors could also apply to a utopia, but the reason it's a dystopia is because it doesn't seem like anyone's really happy.
Right.
Right? It doesn't seem like none of the characters we interact with really seem like content.
I think I was skimming through the book again, and there was one section there when they talk about power.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, if you have power over the other people, the only way you know that it's real power if you can make them hurt. Mm-hmm. Because if you ask them to do something nice and they do it, it says, well, maybe they just wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Right. But if you ask them to do something that's going to hurt them and they still do it,
mm-hmm.
then you mean you have power. So.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's a pretty classic dystopia. I think it's almost also like a perfect dystopia. You and I were talking a bit about this before. I'm not convinced this kind of government could actually exist because of how perfect that the upper echelon must be acting. Like, it requires so much precision
right.
to make this kind of control happen. And I don't know if people as a collective could do it that well. And there's kind of still the question of, like, to what end? Because, like, you know, in Brave New World, the alphas get to have all kinds of nice stuff, right? So there's a reason for them to want to keep the betas and the gammas and the epsilons in their place, because then they get to have a
lot of nice things. Well, here's kind of similar. There's levels of party and also the prawls, right?
Right, but we don't ever see what, like, what does the inner party have that...
That can turn the tell screens off, you know?
Maybe privacy.
A little bit of privacy.
Yeah, maybe that's something.
More chocolate.
More chocolate, that's true. Real coffee. So I think it's a little hard. That probably comes from the point of view structure from
well, part of it, I think this was kind of, there's a lot of the wartime living reflected in it. So especially in England, and more so under in occupied countries, like during the war, if you were in Poland, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that could happen is that, and this is true, this is what happened, Germans would close off a street randomly, get everybody who was on the street, arrest them, and send them off to concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
Just because.
Yeah.
There was a very famous movie made after the war in Poland called Forbidden Songs.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Polish people being Polish people. There would, you know, people would make money by going around the streets singing songs, playing accordions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And very often the lyrics were very, let's say, not approving of the occupation. And the movie is about, you know, basically about those people singing those songs, but often mm-hmm. they would get arrested, or, you know, you can just get shot for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's always been governments that have totalitarian and dictatorship,
right,
and very strong military presence, but I guess the question is sort of the precision that's required in this story to have it be perpetual.
Right.
Because that's one of the things that's described when Winston's reading the book, is that the goal is to stop any possible revolution and to keep those people that are in power permanently in power. But then, you know, I start to ask questions like, well, for what purpose? You know, do the inner party members have families? Do they have children that they want to inherit the power structure? Do they just want to keep the power structure for their friends?
Right.
You know, there's a lot of unanswered questions, and
right,
I think that's kind of probably part of the point of the story, is
right,
that there's an almost, it's almost machine-like in its precision and its control.
Right. Could such a government be even stable? And probably the answer is no.
Right. So in that way, it's like, not only is it sort of like a classic dystopia, but it's kind of like a perfect dystopia in how perfectly run it is.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think we were talking before, is that there's like a range of dystopias. One end is Brave New World,
mm-hmm.
the other end is 1984, and
yeah,
all the others kind of fall on the scale between the two, maybe.
I think so. I mean, it's like a good working hypothesis to go for.
Yeah, when we read
yeah.
other stuff, we can see if it makes sense.
Yeah, because, yeah, Brave New World is like, oh, that dystopia, utopia kind of thing, and but 1984 is clearly a dystopia.
Right.
But, like, I was thinking about the size of the Ministry of Love. So the building, the Ministry of Love, where Winston's ultimately tortured and all this mind control is happening, is huge. And unless, like, maybe the Thought Police have, like, really nice offices or something, and they have, like, a lot of space, but assuming that it's being used for what's going on with Winston for all the people, think about how many, like, there must be so many people that this is happening to. Which means that, like, Winston always wonders, how, you know, does everyone else really buy into this? Or, like, what do people realize that this is all shenanigans? And he's probably right that a large percentage of people realize it's all shenanigans.
Right, but they go along because otherwise
right.
you will get vaporized.
Exactly.
And I've seen, when I was growing up in communist Poland, there was very much a lot of that. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, communism was not particularly loved by the Polish people.
Mm-hmm.
So there was lots of grumbling underneath the surface there.
But there wasn't a lot you could do, yeah.
There was much you could do, no. I just thought about surveillance. Did you ever read Scanner Darkly by Philip K. Dick?
I don't think you made me read that one.
Okay, there's a movie as well. part of the Scanner Darkly is that it's about police that has to surveil people,
mm-hmm.
right? And because it's such undercover surveillance that when the policemen report on the surveillance, they wear the special suit that they distorts their features or whatever, so you can't tell who it is.
Mm-hmm.
And this one guy in the story has to surveil himself. You know, typical Philip K. Dick.
That's
so
cute. did you want to read your quotes?
Yeah, so there's a couple of quotes. that I like in here. They kind of relate to Brave New World, because last time when we talked about Brave New World, it turned out that Huxley was actually teacher of Orwell at one point. And Orwell did not think much of Brave New World.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a line from his book, and I think, "Power is inflicting pain and humiliation. Power is tearing human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. Do you begin to see then what kind of world we are creating? It is the exact opposite of the stupid hedonistic utopias that the old reformers imagined." Right, so Brave New World was a stupid hedonistic utopia.
Yeah, but isn't the government of Brave New World doing just that by genetically predisposing the people to have different minds?
Well, they wanted stability, right? So
right.
Here it's people want power.
Well, they want power too. Part of the government of Brave New World is that, you know, maintaining that system to maintain the power. So they're both getting at the same thing, but in different ways.
Right.
One is definitely much more hedonistic than the other. So.
And the other one that's related to Brave New World as well, it says here, "We have cut the links between child and parent, and between men and men, and between men and woman. No one dares trust a wife or a child or a friend any longer. But in the future, there will be no wives and no friends. Children will be taken from their mothers at birth as one takes egg from a hen. The sex instincts will be eradicated. Procreation will be an annual formality like the renewal of a ration cord. We shall abolish the orgasm." So again, it's like controlling sexuality is kind of a big thing.
Right. So this is something interesting between 1984 and A Brave New World, because both are divorcing sexuality from procreation, but in sort of opposite ways.
Right.
Whereas in 1984, they're trying to totally abolish the sex instinct. In Brave New World, they're sort of actually leaning into it, like, very strongly, right, but not in a procreation kind of way,
right,
in that hedonistic kind of way.
Right.
So that's interesting. It's like the one that's sort of like the utopia-esque dystopia kind of leans into, like, human... It leans into human experience, like, not only just sexuality, but, you know, food that tastes good, movies that are nice, you know, fun experiences, all that kind of stuff. And then this one's leaning into pushing a human to be, you know, almost non-human in a lot of ways.
Right, right.
Which is interesting. I don't know what that means, but it's interesting.
Well, I guess, you know, making a human into a machine,
mm-hmm,
right, is kind of the dystopian idea.
Yeah, I guess that's probably one of the sources of the fear, is that you can't... I think a big fear for people is not being able to be happy, not being able to enjoy yourself.
Right.
So one of the things that's like dreary about 1984 is that what does Winston do for fun?
Nothing.
That's awful.
They make him do exercise.
Right,
in the morning.
Exercise. So, you know, it's... I think that's a big thing with dystopia. It's not just like freedom to do, you know, freedom in an abstract, but like literally freedom to be like, I want to watch Netflix, or
Big Brother says no.
I don't want to be watched by my government right now. You know, like for the very like basic freedoms to do stuff, and mostly it's doing stuff you want to do. That kind of goes, but the quote you just read kind of goes to women in 1984. So there's a few women in 1984. And it's not a huge theme.
Well, there was an interesting one. We didn't talk about it. The prole woman who was singing and hanging up laundry.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
He had a kind of beautiful description of her, too. He kind of describes that she would have grown up and had, like, a bloom, like a year bloom of, like, beauty,
right,
or whatever. And
right,
would have started having children. I would have had, like, 10 or 15 children. And now all she does is laundry and sing. But she's living a much fuller life than he is.
Right.
In a lot of ways. But I think Winston's interactions with women are, you know, very purposeful, in that, like, he, you know, he has his kind of weird memories of his mom. He had this bad experience with his first marriage. He's never really been in love,
right,
or anything like that. And so when he sees women, he doesn't connect with them. He doesn't, for example, you know, O'Brien is the man that he thinks is the person he thinks, like, oh, that person's connecting with me. He doesn't see Julia and think, I'm connecting with her. Until she reaches out to him, he thinks she's like a spy or whatever.
Right.
He doesn't have this like delusional connection with a woman. He has a delusional connection with another man. And that I'm sure that's from his experiences and everything. And Julia's kind of interesting because the narrative tells us several things from Winston's point of view about women in society. They're They're all chaste. They don't like having sex. They're all really into the party.
Right.
You know, they're so orthodox, all these things. And then Julia kind of like just punches through all of that.
Right.
And just like ruins that whole thing, which is good. And then that's kind of the
She's
point.
She's a hippie, yeah.
I think that's kind of the point. Is that
yeah,
it's like,
right.
You want to talk about basic high school literature things?
No, you can talk about that. I just wanted, I want to talk about my impression of this book, first time I read it and this time I read it.
Okay.
So when I read this book years ago, and I found it like the most depressing book ever.
Mm-hmm. I did in high school when I read it too, yeah.
And I was thinking about why, and I think at the time, the fact that, you know, Winston falls in love, and I like that.
Mm-hmm.
As a younger person, I guess much more emotionally alive,
mm-hmm.
or less cynical maybe. And then when that got destroyed, that was, to me, very depressing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that Winston actually was killed at the end. And this time around, wasn't quite as depressing. Didn't feel as depressing because I guess I'm more cynical. And I realized that it's actually ambivalent in the end of the book whether he's shot or not. But
yeah.
it doesn't really matter anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would agree. I don't think it was as... I think maybe part of it is that I knew what was going to happen. I do think that there's a big emotional gut punch when Julia and Winston are separated.
Right.
The first time you read it. And I think that's just based a lot on the fact that as a reader, you're expecting... I mean, it is a dystopia, but you're expecting some, you know, your hero to triumph, right?
Right.
That's the natural, like, normally is what happens. And it's not... But the story's told you from the beginning. It's like reading
right.
it again.
Right.
It's like telling you, like, he's gonna die. He's gonna get shot. He's gonna get caught. You can't keep going with this. It'll be a few months. That's it. And then that's what happens. And it's like, oh my God, how could this have happened? But the other thing, too, is I think when I first read it... So I first read this when I was in, like, middle school. And then I read
middle
it.
School.
Yeah, because Chris was reading it for high school. My older brother, my brother's 5 grades ahead of me, so Chris was reading it for high school, and he loved it. And so I read it at the same time, and then I had to read it for high school. So I went into that's why I fought with my teacher about it.
Tell me about this fight with your teacher. I want to hear about this.
Well, wait. Let me just finish making my point. So my point is that I think that as a younger person, I bought into the romance a lot more, and now as an older person reading it, you can tell that Winston's not really in love with Julia. It's just like he's in love with the fact that they're kind of, you know, doing things
rebels,
against the
yeah.
rules.
Yeah.
But there's nothing particularly about Julia that he likes. He doesn't even particularly like the way she looks or anything like that. She's just kind of like another person he can actually connect with. So it's not really like the loss of a great love or anything like that. It's just kind of, it's more about the loss of his freedom, which he's kind of never had. The fight with my teacher was just about... the choral. So there's a bunch of stuff I was saying before. There's a bunch of stuff in the story that's very, like, straightforward symbolism kind of things that are really easy to understand. So, like, the choral and the glass. Do you want to describe what the choral is?
Yeah, so he, at one point, he at the antique store, he buys this piece of glass with embedded choral in it.
And it's pretty. It's like a rounded piece of glass.
I think he carries it with him. I don't think he brings it to his apartment.
He carries it with him, and then he leaves it in the room.
The room at
yeah,
the...
at the antique shop. It's
right.
But the thing about it is it's flat on one side, so it's a paperweight. It's flat on one side,
yeah.
It's round, and it's round on the top, so the piece of coral is, like, very bright pink, and it looks very big in the glass. And when the thought police come and arrest them, they knock it over, and it shatters, and he sees the coral, and the coral is actually quite small. And, shocker, it's a metaphor. It's a symbol. It's actually, I think it's more of a metaphor. It's, you know, their world, their little world that they built in the room that looked so big and important and beautiful, shattering, and actually being so small and being so weak. Ta-da! That's it. So, when I was in high school, I had read the story before.
Yeah.
I didn't quite fight with my teacher exactly, but I had read
you
the
disagree.
Story before. I disagreed with a lot of my teachers, but no, this was actually, I read the story before, so I went into it knowing this metaphor already, like, because it was there, and I think Chris and I had talked about it, or something that he had been taught, or something, I knew about it, so we were in, like, small groups, and in my small group, I told them about the choral thing, and they all thought it was neat, and then one person from each small group had to present the thing
right.
they were doing, whatever, so I talked about the choral, whatever. And then when I came home later that day, I spoke to my best friend who had the same English teacher, but in a later class period. And we were talking about 1984, and I was like, do you know about the choral thing? And she's like, yeah. And she repeated back to me verbatim what I had said in class earlier. But she wasn't in my class. And I was like, where did you hear that? And she's like, oh, our teacher, Miss Smith, taught it to us today. And I'm like, what? And I was like, she didn't teach that to us. And she's like, well, isn't that where you got it from? I'm like, no, she got it from me. And I was very annoyed.
That's funny.
But I mean, I got it from Chris, who got it from some other, like, that was like a stream of things. But yeah, it was pretty funny. So the coral in the glass is a straightforward one. Fear of rats. Winston's afraid of rats. Rats live in the walls.
Rather than everybody would be afraid of rats eating your face, so.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the whole idea of, like, there is something behind the wall watching you kind of thing. Mm. It's a metaphor. Winston Smith's name is always a thing. Anytime you go to read a Spark Notes, they're all like, the name is significant. Like, it's supposed to be, like, Winston Churchill
was, you know, the famous politician and
right.
around that time.
And it's like Winston is like the big powerful name and Smith is a very common name. So it's a juxtaposition of those things.
I see.
It's deep and important. Yeah. So this is what I'm saying. It's like some of these things are very basic.
Very high school.
I want to talk about doublethink.
Okay.
This is the thing I think is really cool about this story that I did not realize until this read.
What is doublethink?
So doublethink within the confines of the universe of 1984 is a thought control idea that means you can believe earnestly two opposite things at the same time. And it's a crucial bit of thought control that you can, you know, be Winston Smith changing an article to rewrite history. And while you're doing it, simultaneously believe the history you are fabricating.
Right.
So that's what doublethink is. It's believing two opposite things at once. It can be used broader, too. They do, throughout the story, sometimes use it in other circumstances. But that's the basic idea. And this is where the novel gets really meta. And I love it. And this is what I think some of the ideas in the story are very straightforward high school. And some of the ideas in the story have a very high literary merit, which is one of the reasons I think that 1984 has been so influential and really surpassed time. Doublethink is at the core of dystopia and at the core of fiction. And this is what I mean by that. So take at the core of fiction, for example. You need to, as a reader, employ doublethink to enjoy fiction, ever. Whether it's reading it or watching it or whatever. Because you need to believe enough in the characters and the stories that you're seeing that you experience real emotion when you're engaging with it, simultaneously knowing they're fictional. But getting to a point where you're so invested, I mean, you have people that are so invested in things like Harry Potter or like Game of Thrones, things like that, that it's very emotionally real, but you know it's not.
Right.
So it's
well, it's a, this is an old question in philosophy. Is Sherlock Holmes real?
Ask Big Brother, because he was
Is Big Brother real, right?
Right. So, exactly, that's the thing. It's like, it gets into that, like, what is reality? And doublethink is necessary to enjoy fiction.
So what about dystopia? How does it relate to dystopia?
So the way I'm thinking about it with dystopia is, like, we were talking about last time, that dystopia and utopia are kind of very, very, they're like the same, they're like two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
Right. At what point in time does something become a dystopia? At what point in time does it become a utopia? Which is a little bit more apparent with Brave New World. So, I mean, doublethink, I guess I'm using it in a more broad sense with regarding those the two, because they're the two opposites that are so close. So I'm not quite sure if it applies directly, but it's like, I'm not trying to think of how to explain it exactly. Mm-hmm. I thought about it yesterday. I guess it's less dystopia and less something like this, where like this is a straightforward, pretty clear dystopia, and more something like Brave New World, where you simultaneously have, you know, everything you can want, right? All of these things, but also the really legitimate question as to whether or not this is a utopia or dystopia, and that you could have in your mind both the satisfaction of the pleasures you are experiencing and the dissatisfaction with the life you are living. At the same time. So that's how I was thinking about it applying to... I don't think it applies to 1984 in that way.
No. That's clearly bad all around.
I think doublethink can also sort of be a synonym for like meta commentary in that way, in like the fiction kind of way. And I think that when if you read 1984 with Doublethink in mind throughout, it pops up constantly. It's insane how often it pops up and it is applicable to things throughout the story.
But I'm wondering if Doublethink can also be applied in real life to real things and be dangerous. And you know, so if you think about the war and stuff, right, you know you have to go and kill other people, mm-hmm. right? And that's like the thing you want to do and you believe in it, yet you know there are other people kind of just like you and they will suffer pain and stuff mm-hmm. when you kill them. So
we probably employ Doublethink all the time. Mm. I mean, constantly. It's kind of one of those things where it's like there's not, because there is no real, like, single correct way to live, right? There's no way to really reconcile all of those things. Because, you know, you can justify war or not justify war depending on your position. And that's why I think point of view chapter writing is so interesting. The other thing about Doublethink and meta-commentary in Brave New World is there's a section...
Brave New World? Or
I'm sorry, 1984. I was reading the notes. In 1984, there's a section during the rat torture chapter, which is the second to last chapter, I think, mm-hmm. of the book, where O'Brien is doing the torture. And Winston describes that... Winston asks a question or something, and O'Brien's going to answer, and he describes that O'Brien looks past Winston as if he's addressing an audience... and then begins to explain. And I found this to be very breaking the fourth wall. So the idea of breaking the fourth wall is when a character in a story directly addresses the audience or acknowledges that it is in a story. So like, you know, when people stare right at the camera on The Office, for example.
Right, on the Shakespeare's play, the
yeah.
characters talk to the audience.
Right, you know, that's breaking the fourth wall. And so... this idea, like, if imagine, like picture that. Like, you have, like, Winston, like, sitting in a chair or whatever in the middle of the room. O'Brien's in front of him. Winston asks a question, and O'Brien looks past him and is looking at you. He's looking at the reader and explaining.
That's creepy.
It's super creepy. And I think it plays into this whole double-think meta-commentary kind of situation that's happening. And I think it's fantastic. And that's... why you can read this book for a college course, too, and I'll write about it.
And what about Newspeak, then? We didn't talk much about that.
Yeah, so there weren't that many new science fiction ideas in 1984. I think Doublethink is probably one of the most interesting ones. Or, yeah, I think it's the most interesting one.
Technologically, was the telescreens and all the...
Yeah,
I always said, you know, these days it would be a lot easier to work at Ministry of Truth. Because you just have to revise computer files, not...
exactly.
Not actual papers.
Yeah, you can just use Photoshop. You don't need to, like, make a whole new set to take a picture. Newspeak was really interesting. And it didn't really do anything in the story. It wasn't, like, an active thing. You want to explain what Newspeak is?
Right, so Newspeak was this new language that the party was developing to replace English. And basically what they were trying to do is to reduce the number of words and number of meanings you could express. Mm-hmm. So that... to the point where you could not have a revolution because there would not be language to talk about revolution.
Right.
It's just kind of a weird way to think about it, but it's true. It's like language, if you don't have the language to express something, you cannot think about the thing.
Right, well, you and I have talked about this at length in some of the other podcasts that we've done because the previous section of books that we did were all weird aliens.
Right.
And all the communication stuff. Right. I think you linked that TED Talk
one right.
before. Because that's very true. If you don't have the words to describe it, how, you know, can you even, how do you can't express a complex idea unless you have the words for it?
Yeah, how can you know what a flip-flop flugla is if you don't have the word for it, you know?
Exactly. So the idea for Newspeak is that they were just reducing, and it leads to some cool ideas, like instead of having the words good and bad, you have good and ungood.
Right.
That's it. Well, you don't need the whole, what, you don't need the word bad if you have ungood. If it's really good, it's plus good. If it's really, really good, it's double plus good. If it's really, really bad, double plus ungood. You don't need all these extra words and synonyms.
And actually, the book, the 1984 book, has like a chapter at the end about Newspeak. Was that written by Orwell? Or?
I don't know. It started to play on my Audible, but I didn't listen to the whole thing.
Yeah, I didn't read it either.
Yeah, it was like, I don't want to read about regular English grammar. I'm not going to read about it. What about, just to start wrapping up, what about 1984's influence on things? This is what I was thinking about. There's an episode of Star Trek Next Generation where Captain Picard, I think, gets captured by a Cardassian or something and is tortured. And you know how they do the whole thing with Winston with the five fingers, four fingers thing?
Yeah.
So O'Brien holds up four fingers,
Yeah.
And he's trying to convince Winston that he's really holding up five fingers. And eventually, Winston, you know, capitulates to that. They do almost the exact same thing in that Star Trek episode.
That's right.
With the four lights.
Yes.
He puts up four lights, and then the car's like, ah, there's five lights. And I was listening to it again, and I'm like, wait a minute, this sounds familiar.
The book had tremendous cultural influence. It's like seeped into everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people used doublethink and newspeak. Things are Orwellian.
It's become an adjective. And, I mean, I don't know why that is. Why do you think it's... I mean, I think part of its lasting effect is it does have a very high literary value in... It's well-written.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's, like, the world's greatest writing in the world, but it's well-written. And I think it does have high literary value in how it makes you think about these issues.
But, you know, since the late 40s, there was the Cold War and the communists versus the West, perhaps this book was kind of used as an example, saying, see what would happen if communism took over, one party ruled. So, but I guess it just resonates with people.
Mm-hmm. I think also the fact that your hero doesn't win in the end makes it different from a lot of other books. Because I think a lot of times there's at least some feeling of success at the end of, your main character is just like this guy who's getting pushed down.
Well, George Orwell was also a very influential writer, so he wrote a lot of book essays on politics and stuff. Mm-hmm. So
he wrote one in the middle of this book.
Right. I haven't read any of them. We all read Animal Farm.
Yeah, everybody's read Animal Farm, yeah.
But it's interesting. It's like some of the ideas maybe are reflected by the current world where people try to, the so-called fake news.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you go looking at various websites that try to troll people, they misrepresent the facts.
Mm-hmm.
The propaganda is a real thing,
mm-hmm.
And you can convince people to your point of view by essentially lying. And some clever ways.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, propaganda as a tool was only invented in the 20th century.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess like there wasn't really... You need like a rather widespread communication for it to work.
From what I've read, it's really kind of really started World War I. Because,
mm-hmm.
The various armies needed young men to join and be patriotic and go fight the other side. So... If you look at World War I recruitment posters, in England, that's English ones, you see, go fight the Hun, and you can see this ugly German carrying off a young woman,
mm-hmm.
The usual. And, of course, the Nazi Germany propaganda was kind of brought up to the art. And in fact, what they had in Germany, that was 30s and 40s, in Nazi Germany, is radio became like a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody had a radio, and there was like a state channel that everybody listened to. So it's very much, I bet you that's what inspired the telescreens.
Oh, yeah.
To the point where they had like even, for people who couldn't own radios, they had speakers that publicly set up so they could hear Hitler's speeches.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Nick, if this story would happen nowadays, like how this would take like the cell phone into account,
Maybe we should rewrite it as 2084.
Oh man, that's it. Dear listeners, someone out there, rewrite 1984 as 2084. Make it work. So what do we have coming up?
So next one, we're going to do another Lem.
Oh boy!
You are very excited. It's called Return from the Stars.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those ambiguous dystopias.
I'm shocked Lem is ambiguous.
And
what? I always feel such a sense of concrete completeness at the end of his stories.
This one actually ends logically with things being actually coming to an end, but as I recall.
And then what do we do? Did we decide what we're doing after that? Because that'll be our third dystopia. I know we talked about Hunger Games.
Yes, that's the Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever read the Hunger Games before?
No, I saw the movie.
Okay. So we can read the first book and watch the first movie, maybe,
mm-hmm.
and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to see where that falls on our potential spectrum of Brave New World to 1984.
Right. Right.
It's kind of a mixture.
Right.
So it's in the middle. Perfect.
from the movie, it seems closer to the 1984 than Brave New World.
Yes. From that point of view.
Katniss is a pro, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So. All right, I think that's all we have for today. Thanks so much for listening, everyone.
Okay.
I'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Hello, and welcome to History in Reverse,
Oops.
It's for the Easter egg.